pavilion, joined to two other buildings by covered pathways. She inquired about the progress of Aragon's training and the state of his back, both of which he described with brief, polite phrases. This seemed to satisfy the queen, who exchanged a few words with Saphira and then departed. In the end, they returned to the garden. Aragon walked beside Arya, Saphira trailing behind, entranced by the sound of her voice as she told him about the different varieties of flowers, where they originated, how they were maintained, and in many instances, how they had been altered with magic. She also pointed out the flowers that only open their petals during the night, like a white datura. "Which one is your favourite?" he asked. Arya smiled and escorted him to a tree on the edge of the garden, by a pond lined with rushes. Around the tree's lowest branch coiled a morning glory, with three velvety black blossoms that were clenched shut. Blowing on them, Arya whispered, "Open." The petals rustled as they unfurled, fanning their inky robes to expose the hoard of nectar in their centres. A starburst of royal blue filled the flowers' throats, diffusing into the sable corolla like the vestiges of day into night. "Is it not the most perfect and lovely flower?" asked Arya. Aragon gazed at her, exquisitely aware of how close they were, and said, "Yes, it is." Before his courage deserted him, he added, "As are you."
"Aragon!"
exclaimed Saphira. Arya fixed her eyes upon him, studying him until he was forced to look away. When he dared face her again, he was mortified to see her wearing a faint smile, as if amused by his reaction. "You are too kind," she murmured. Reaching up, she touched the rim of a blossom and glanced from it to him. "Faelin created this especially for me, one summer solstice, long ago." He shuffled his feet and responded with a few unintelligible words, hurt and offended that she did not take his compliment more seriously. He wished he could turn invisible, and even considered trying to cast a spell that would allow him to do just that. In the end, he drew himself upright and said, "Please excuse us, Arias Fitcona, but it is late, and we must return to our tree." Her smile deepened. "Of course, Aragon, I understand." She accompanied them to the main archway, opened the doors for them, and said, "Good night, Saphira." "Good night, Aragon."
"Good night,"
replied Saphira. Despite his embarrassment, Aragon could not help asking, "Will we see you tomorrow?" Arya tilted her head. "I think I shall be busy tomorrow." Then the doors closed, cutting off his view of her as she returned to the main compound. Crouching low on the path, Saphira nudged Aragon in the side.
"Stop daydreaming and get on my back!"
Climbing up her left foreleg, he took his usual place, then clutched the neck spike in front of him as Saphira rose to her full height. After a few steps,
"How can you criticize my behavior with Glada and then go and do something like that? What were you thinking?"
"You know how I feel about her," he grumbled.
"Pah! If you are my conscience and I am yours, then it's my duty to tell you when you're acting like a deluded popinjay. You're not using logic, like Oromis keeps telling us to. What do you really expect to happen between you and Arya? She's a princess!"
"And I'm a rider!"
"She's an elf. You're a human."
"I look more like an elf every day."
"Aragon, she's over 100 years old.
"I'll live as long as her or any elf."
"Ah, but you haven't yet, and that's the problem. You can't overcome such a vast difference. She's a grown woman with a century of experience, while you're..."
"What? What am I?" he snarled. "A child? Is that what you mean?"
"No, not a child. Not after what you have seen and done since we were joined. But you are young, even by the reckoning of your short-lived race, much less by that of the dwarves, dragons, and elves."
"As are you." His retort silenced her for a minute, then...
I'm just trying to protect you, Aragorn. That's all. I want you to be happy, and I'm afraid you won't be if you insist on pursuing Arya.
The two of them were about to retire when they heard the trapdoor in the vestibule bang open and the jingle of mail as someone climbed inside. Zarok in hand, Aragorn threw back the screen door, ready to confront the intruder. His hand dropped as he saw Oryk on the floor. The dwarf took a hearty draught from the bottle he wielded in his left hand, then squinted at Aragorn.
"Bricks and bones, where be you? Ah, there you stand! I wondered where you were, couldn't find you, so I thought that given this fine dolorous night, I might go find you. And here you are! What shall we talk about, you and I, now that we're together in this delectable bird's nest?"
Taking hold of the dwarf's free arm, Aragorn pulled him upright, surprised as he always was by how dense Oryk was, like a miniature boulder. When Aragorn removed his support, Oryk swayed from one side to the other, achieving such precarious angles that he threatened to topple at the slightest provocation. "Come on in," said Aragorn in his own language. He closed the trapdoor. "You'll catch cold out here." Oryk blinked his round, deep-set eyes at Aragorn.
"I've not seen you round my leafy exile. No, I haven't. You've abandoned me to the company of elves, and miserable, dull company they are. Yes, indeed."
A touch of guilt made Aragorn disguise himself with an awkward smile. He had forgotten the dwarf amid the goings-on. "I'm sorry I haven't visited you, Oryk, but my studies have kept me busy. Here, give me your cloak." As he helped the dwarf out of his brown mantle, he asked, "What are you drinking?"
"Fail nerve," declared Oryk. "A most wonderful, ticklish potion. The best and greatest of the elves' tricksy inventions. It gives you the gift of loquation. Words float from your tongue like shoals of flapping minnows, like flocks of breathless hummingbirds, like rivers of writhing snakes."
He paused, apparently taken by the unique magnificence of his similes. As Aragorn ushered him into the bedroom, Oryk saluted Saphira with his bottle and said,
"Greetings, O Iron Tooth! May your scales shine as bright as the coals of Morgothol's forge."
"Greetings, Oryk," said Saphira,
laying her head on the rim of her bed.
"What has put you in this state? It is not like you."
Aragorn repeated her question.
"What has put me in mine state?" repeated Oryk.
He dropped into the chair that Aragorn provided, his feet dangling several inches above the ground, and began to shake his head.
"Red cap, green cap, elves here and elves there. I drown in elves and their thrice-damned courtesy. Bloodless they be, taciturn they are. Yesha, nosha, three bags full, sir. Yet nary a pip more can I extract."
He looked at Aragorn with a mournful expression.
"What am I to do while you meander through your instruction? Am I to sit and twiddle mine thumbs while I turn to stone and join the spirits of mine ancestors? Tell me, O sagacious rider,
have you no skills or hobbies that you might occupy yourself with?"
asked Saphira.
"Aye," said Oryk. "I am a fair enough smith by any who'd care to judge. But why should I craft bright arms and armour for those who treasure them not? I'm useless here, as useless as a three-legged Feldenost."
Aragorn extended a hand toward the bottle. "May I?" Oric glanced between him and the bottle, then grimaced and gave it up. The fail nerve was cold as ice as it ran down Aragorn's throat, stinging and smarting. He blinked as his eyes watered. After he indulged in a second quaff, he passed the bottle back to Oric, who seemed disappointed by how little of the concoction remained.
"And what mischief," asked Oric, "have you two managed to ferret out of Oromis and yon bucolic woods?"
The dwarf alternately chuckled and groaned as Aragorn described his training, his misplaced blessing in Farthendur, the Manoa tree, his back, and all else that had filled the past few days. Aragorn ended with the topic that was dearest to him at the moment, Arya. Emboldened by the liqueur, he confessed his affection for her, and described how she had dismissed his advance. Wagging a finger, Oric said,
"The rock beneath you is flawed, Aragorn. Don't tempt fate."
"Arya..." He stopped, then growled and took another gulp of Failnerve.
"Oh, it's too late for this. Who am I to say what is wisdom and what isn't?"
Saphira had closed her eyes a while ago. Without opening them, she asked,
"Are you married, Oric?"
The question surprised Aragorn. He had never stopped to wonder about Oric's personal life.
"Etta," said Oric, "though I'm promised to fair Hvedra, daughter of Thorgard One-Eye and Himinglada. We were to be wed this spring until the Urgals attacked and Hrothgar sent me on this accursed trip."
"Is she of Durgrimsting Jeetum?" asked Aragorn.
"Of course," roared
Oric, pounding his fist on the side of the chair.
"Thinkest thou I would marry outside my clan? She's the granddaughter of mine aunt Vardrun, Hrothgar's cousin twice removed, with white round calves as smooth as satin, cheeks as red as apples, and the prettiest dwarf maid who ever did exist."
"Undoubtedly," said Saphira.
"I'm sure it won't be long before you see her again," said Aragorn.
"Humph,"
Oric squinted at Aragorn.
"Do you believe in giants? Tall giants, strong giants, thick and bearded giants with fingers like spades."
"I've never seen nor heard of them," said Aragorn, "except in stories. If they do exist, it's not in Alagaesia."
"Oh, but they do! They do!"
exclaimed Oric, waving the bottle about his head.
"Tell me, O rider, if a fearsome giant were to meet you on the garden path, what might he call you, if not dinner?"
"Aragorn, I would presume."
"No, no! He'd call you a dwarf. For dwarf you'd be to him."
Oric guffawed and nudged Aragorn in the ribs with his hard elbow.
"See you now! Humans and elves are the giants. The land's full of them, here, there, and everywhere, stomping about with their big feet and casting us in endless shadows."
He continued laughing, rocking back in his chair until it tipped over and he fell to the floor with a solid thump. Helping him upright, Aragorn said, "I think you'd better stay here for the night. You're in no condition to go down those stairs in the dark." Oric agreed with cheery indifference. He allowed Aragorn to remove his mail and bundle him onto one side of the bed. Afterward, Aragorn sighed, covered the lights, and lay on his side of the mattress. He fell asleep, hearing the dwarf mutter,
"Hvedra, Hvedra, Hvedra."
The Nature of Evil. Bright morning arrived all too soon. Jolted to awareness by the buzz of the vibrating timepiece, Aragorn grabbed his hunting knife and sprang out of bed, expecting an attack. He gasped as his body shrieked with protest from the abuse of the past 2 days. Blinking away tears, Aragorn rewound the timepiece. Oric was gone. The dwarf must have slipped away in the wee hours of the morning. With a groan, Eragon hobbled to the wash-closet for his daily ablutions, like an old man afflicted by rheumatism. He and Saphira waited by the tree for 10 minutes before they were met by a solemn, black-haired elf. The elf bowed, touched 2 fingers to his lips, which Eragon mirrored, and then preempted Eragon by saying, "May good fortune rule over you." "And may the stars watch over you," replied Eragon. "Did Oromis send you?" The elf ignored him and said to Saphira, "Well met, dragon. I am Vanna of House Haldthin." Eragon scowled with annoyance.
"Well met, Vanna."
Only then did the elf address Eragon. "I will show you where you may practice with your blade." He strode away, not waiting for Eragon to catch up. The sparring yard was dotted with elves of both sexes, fighting in pairs and groups. Their extraordinary physical gifts resulted in flurries of blows so quick and fast they sounded like bursts of hail striking an iron bell. Under the trees that fringed the yard, individual elves performed the Rimgar with more grace and flexibility than Eragon thought he would ever achieve. After everyone on the field stopped and bowed to Saphira, Vanna unsheathed his narrow blade.
"If you will guard your sword, Silverhand, we can begin."
Eragon eyed the inhuman swordsmanship of the other elves with trepidation.
"Why do I have to do this?" he asked. "I'll just be humiliated."
"You'll be fine," said Saphira,
yet he could sense her concern for him.
"Right."
As he prepared Zarok, Eragon's hands trembled with dread. Instead of throwing himself into the fray, he fought Vanna from a distance, dodging, sidestepping, and doing everything possible to avoid triggering another fit. Despite Eragon's evasions, Vanna touched him 4 times in rapid succession, once each on his ribs, shin, and both shoulders. Vanna's initial expression of stoic impassivity soon devolved into open contempt. Dancing forward, he slid his blade up Zarok's length, while at the same time twirling Zarok in a circle, wrenching Eragon's wrist. Eragon allowed Zarok to fly out of his hand rather than resist the elf's superior strength. Vanna dropped his sword onto Eragon's neck and said,
"Dead."
Shrugging off the sword, Eragon trudged over to retrieve Zarok.
"Dead," said Vanna. "How do you expect to defeat Galbatorix like this? I expected better, even from a weakling human."
"Then why don't you fight Galbatorix yourself instead of hiding in Dueldenvarden?" Vanna stiffened with outrage.
"Because," he said, cool and haughty, "I'm not a rider, and if I were, I would not be such a coward as you."
No one moved or spoke on the field. His back to Vanna, Eragon leaned on Zarok and craned his neck toward the sky, snarling to himself, "He knows nothing. This is just one more test to overcome."
"Coward, I say. Your blood is as thin as the rest of your races. I think that Saphira was confused by Galbatorix's wiles and made the wrong choice of rider."
The spectating elves gasped at Vanna's words and muttered among themselves with open disapproval for his atrocious breach of etiquette. Eragon ground his teeth. He could stand insults to himself, but not to Saphira. She was already moving when his pent-up frustration, fear and pain burst within him, and he whirled around, the tip of Zarok whistling through the air. The blow would have killed Vanna had he not blocked it at the last second. He looked surprised by the ferocity of the attack. Holding nothing in reserve, Eragon drove Vanna to the centre of the field, jabbing and slashing like a madman, determined to hurt the elf however he could. He nicked Vanna on the hip with enough force to draw blood, even with Zarok's blunted edge. At that instant, Eragon's back ruptured in an explosion of agony so intense he experienced it with all 5 senses, as a deafening, crashing waterfall of sound, a metallic taste that coated his tongue, an acrid, eye-watering stench in his nostrils, redolent of vinegar, pulsing colours, and above all, the feeling that Durza had just laid open his back. He could see Vanna standing over him with a derisive sneer. It occurred to Eragon that Vanna was very young. After the seizure, Aragorn wiped the blood from his mouth with his hand and showed it to Vanna, asking, "Thin enough?" Vanna did not deign to respond, but rather sheathed his sword and walked away. "Where are you going?" demanded Aragorn. "We have unfinished business, you and I."
"You are in no fit condition to spar," scoffed the elf.
"Try me." Aragorn might be inferior to the elves, but he refused to give them the satisfaction of fulfilling their low expectations of him. He would earn their respect through sheer persistence, if nothing else. He insisted on completing Oromus's assigned hour, after which Saphira marched up to Vanna and touched him on the chest with the point of one of her ivory talons.
"Dead,"
she said. Vanna paled. The other elves edged away from him. Once they were in the air, Saphira said,
"Oromus was right."
"About what?"
"You give more of yourself when you have an opponent."
At Oromus's hut, the day resumed its usual pattern. Saphira accompanied Gleda for her instruction, while Aragorn remained with Oromus. Aragorn was horrified when he discovered that Oromus expected him to do the Rimgar in addition to his earlier exercises. It took all of his courage to obey. His apprehension proved groundless, though, for the dance of snake and crane was too gentle to injure him. That, coupled with his meditation in the secluded glade, provided Aragorn with his first opportunity since the previous day to order his thoughts and consider the question that Oromus had posed him. While he did, he observed his red ants invade a smaller rival anthill, overrunning the inhabitants and stealing their resources. By the end of the massacre, only a handful of the rival ants were left alive, alone and purposeless in the vast and hostile Pine Needle Barrens. "Like the dragons in Alagazia," thought Aragorn. His connection to the ants vanished as he considered the dragon's unhappy fate. Bit by bit, an answer to his problem revealed itself to him, an answer that he could live with and believe in. He finished his meditations and returned to the hut. This time Oromus seemed reasonably satisfied with what Aragorn had accomplished. As Oromus served the midday meal, Aragorn said, "I know why fighting Galbatorix is worth it, though thousands of people may die."
"Oh?" Oromus seated himself. "Do tell me."
"Because Galbatorix has already caused more suffering over the past 100 years than we ever could in a single generation. And unlike a normal tyrant, we cannot wait for him to die. He could rule for centuries or millennia, persecuting and tormenting people the entire time, unless we stop him. If he became strong enough, he would march on the dwarves and you here in Dwellendvarden and kill or enslave both races. And," Aragorn rubbed the heel of his palm against the edge of the table, "because rescuing the 2 eggs from Galbatorix is the only way to save the dragons."
The strident warble of Oromus's tea kettle intruded, escalating in volume until Aragorn's ears rang. Standing, Oromus hooked the kettle off the cook fire and poured the water for blueberry tea. The creases around his eyes softened.
"Now," he said, "you understand."
"I understand, but I take no pleasure in it."
"Nor should you. But now we can be confident that you won't shrink from the path when you are confronted by the injustices and atrocities that the Varden will inevitably commit. We cannot afford to have you consumed by doubts when your strength and focus are most needed."
Oromus steepled his fingers and gazed into the dark mirror of his tea, contemplating whatever he saw in its tenebrous reflection.
"Do you believe that he considers himself evil?"
"No, I doubt it."
Oromus tapped his forefingers against each other.
"Then you must also believe that Durza was evil."
The fragmented memories Aragorn had gleaned from Durza when they fought in Trondheim returned to him now, reminding him how the young shade, Kar-Saib, then, had been enslaved by the wraiths he had summoned to avenge the death of his mentor, Haig.
"He wasn't evil himself, but the spirits that controlled him were."
"And what of the Urgals?" asked Oromus, sipping his tea. "Are they evil?"
Aragorn's knuckles whitened as he gripped his spoon.
"When I think of death, I see an Urgal's face. They're worse than beasts, the things they have done!"
He shook his head, unable to continue.
Aragorn, what kind of opinion would you form of humans if all you knew of them were the actions of your warriors on the field of battle?
That's not... He took a deep breath. It's different. Urgles deserve to be wiped out, every last one of them.
Even their females and children? The ones who haven't harmed you and likely never will? The innocents? Would you kill them and condemn an entire race to the void?
They wouldn't spare us, given the chance.
Aragorn, exclaimed Oromus in biting tones, I never want to hear you use that excuse again. That because someone else has done or would do something means that you should too. It's lazy, repugnant, and indicative of an inferior mind. Am I clear?
Yes, master.
The elf raised his mug to his lips and drank, his bright eyes fixed on Aragorn the entire time.
What do you actually know of Urgles?
I know their strengths, weaknesses, and how to kill them. It's all I need to know.
Why do they hate and fight humans, though? What about their history and legends, or the way in which they live?
Does it matter?
Oromis sighed.
Just remember, he said gently, that at a certain point your enemies may have to become your allies. Such is the nature of life.
Aragorn resisted the urge to argue. He swirled his own tea in its mug, accelerating the liquid into a black whirlpool with a white lens of foam at the bottom of the vortex.
Is that why Galbatorix enlisted the Urgles?
That is not an example I would have chosen, but yes.
It seems strange that he befriended them. After all, they were the ones who killed his dragon. Look what he did to us, the riders, and we weren't even responsible for his loss.
Ah, said Oromis, mad Galbatorix may be, but he's still as cunning as a fox. I guess that he intended to use the Urgles to destroy the Varden and the dwarves, and others if he had triumphed in Farthendur, thereby removing two of his enemies, while simultaneously weakening the Urgles, so that he could dispose of them at his leisure.
Study of the ancient language devoured the afternoon, whereupon they took up the practice of magic. Much of Oromus's lectures concerned the proper way in which to control various forms of energy, such as light, heat, electricity, and even gravity. He explained that since these forces consume strength faster than any other type of spell, it was safer to find them already in existence in nature and then shape them with grammary, instead of trying to create them from nothing. Abandoning the subject, Oromus asked,
How would you kill with magic?
I've done it many ways, said Aragorn. I've hunted with a pebble, moving and aiming it with magic, as well as using the word Geirda to break Urgles' legs and necks. Once, with Thrister, I stopped a man's heart.
There are more efficient methods, revealed Oromis. What does it take to kill a man, Aragorn? A sword through the chest, a broken neck, the loss of blood? All it takes is for a single artery in the brain to be pinched off, or for certain nerves to be severed. With the right spell, you could obliterate an army.
I should have thought of that in Farthendur, said Aragorn, disgusted with himself. Not just Farthendur, either, but also when the Cull chased us from the Hadarach Desert. Again, why didn't Brom teach me this?
Because he did not expect you to face an army for months or years to come. It is not a tool given to untested riders.
If it's so easy to kill people, though, what's the point of us or Galbatorix raising an army?
To be succinct, tactics. Magicians are vulnerable to physical attack when they are embroiled in their mental struggles. Therefore, they need warriors to protect them. And the warriors must be shielded, at least in part, from magical attacks, else they would be slain within minutes. These limitations mean that when armies confront one another, their magicians are scattered throughout the bulk of their forces, close to the edge, but not so close as to be in danger. The magicians on both sides open their minds and attempt to sense if anyone is using or is about to use magic. Since their enemies might be beyond their mental reach,
Magicians also erect wards around themselves and their warriors to stop or lessen long-range attacks, such as a pebble sent flying toward their head from a mile away.
"Surely one man can't defend an entire army," said Aragorn.
"Not alone, but with enough magicians you can provide a reasonable amount of protection. The greatest danger in this sort of conflict is that a clever magician may think of a unique attack that can bypass your wards without tripping them. That itself could be enough to decide a battle." "Also," said Oromis, "you must keep in mind that the ability to use magic is exceedingly rare among the races. We elves are no exception, although we have a greater allotment of spellweavers than most, as a result of oaths we bound ourselves with centuries ago. The majority of those blessed with magic have little or no appreciable talent. They struggle to heal even so much as a bruise." Aragorn nodded. He had encountered magicians like that in the Varden.
"But it still takes the same amount of energy to accomplish a task."
"Energy, yes, but lesser magicians find it harder than you or I do to feel the flow of magic and immerse themselves in it. Few magicians are strong enough to pose a threat to an entire army. And those who are usually spend the bulk of their time during battles evading, tracking, or fighting their opposites, which is fortunate from the standpoint of ordinary warriors, else they would all soon be killed."
Troubled, Aragorn said, "The Varden don't have many magicians."
"That is one reason why you are so important." A moment passed as Aragorn reflected on what Oromis had told him.
"These wards, do they only drain energy from you when they are activated?"
"Aye."
"Then, given enough time, you could acquire countless layers of wards. You could make yourself..."
He struggled with the ancient language as he attempted to express himself.
"Untouchable? Impregnable? Impregnable to any assault, magical or physical."
"Wards," said Oromis, "rely upon the strength of your body. If that strength is exceeded, you die. No matter how many wards you have, you will only be able to block attacks so long as your body can sustain the output of energy."
"And Galbatorix's strength has been increasing each year. How is that possible?"
It was a rhetorical question, yet when Oromis remained silent, his almond eyes fixed on a trio of swallows pirouetting overhead, Aragorn realized that the elf was considering how best to answer him. The birds chased each other for several minutes. When they flitted from view, Oromis said,
"It is not appropriate to have this discussion at the present."
"Then you know?" exclaimed Aragorn, astonished.
"I do, but that information must wait until later in your training. You are not ready for it."
Oromis looked at Aragorn as if expecting him to object. Aragorn bowed.
"As you wish, master."
He could never prize the information out of Oromis until the elf was willing to share it, so why try?
Still, he wondered what could be so dangerous that Oromis dared not tell him, and why the elves had kept it secret from the Varden. Another thought presented itself to him, and he said, "If battles with magicians are conducted like you said, then why did Argiard let me fight without wards in Farthendur? I didn't even know that I needed to keep my mind open for enemies. And why didn't Arya kill most or all of the Urgals? No magicians were there to oppose her except for Durza, and he couldn't have defended his troops when he was underground."
"Did not Argiard have Arya or one of Dúvrangar Gata set defences around you?" demanded Oromis.
"No, master."
"And you fought thus?"
"Yes, master."
Oromis's eyes unfocused, withdrawing into himself as he stood motionless on the greensward. He spoke without warning.
"I have consulted Arya, and she says that the twins of the Varden were ordered to assess your abilities. They told Argiard you were competent in all magic, including wards. Neither Argiard nor Arya doubted their judgment on that matter."
"Those smooth-tongued, bald-pated, tig-infested, treacherous dogs!" swore Aragorn. "They tried to get me killed!"
Reverting to his own language, he indulged in several more pungent oaths.
"Do not befoul the air," said Aramis mildly. "It ill becomes you. In any case, I suspect the twins allowed you into battle unprotected, not so you would be killed, but so that Durza could capture you."
"What?"
"By your own account, Argihard suspected that the Varden had been betrayed when Galbatorix began persecuting their allies in the Empire with near-perfect accuracy. The twins were privy to the identities of the Varden's collaborators. Also, the twins lured you to the heart of Trondheim, thereby separating you from Saphira and placing you within Durza's reach. That they were traitors is the logical explanation."
"If they were traitors," said Aragon, "it doesn't matter now. They're long dead."
Aramis inclined his head. "Even so, Arya said that the Urgals did have magicians in Fardan Dûr, and that she fought many of them. None of them attacked you?"
"No, master."
"More evidence that you and Saphira were left for Durza to capture and take to Galbatorix. The trap was well laid."
Over the next hour, Aramis taught Aragon 12 methods to kill, none of which took more energy than lifting an ink-laden pen. As he finished memorizing the last one, a thought struck Aragon that caused him to grin. "The Razak won't stand a chance the next time they cross my path."
"You must still be wary of them," cautioned Aramis.
"Why, 3 words and they'll be dead."
"What do ospreys eat?"
Aragon blinked.
"Fish, of course."
"And if a fish were slightly faster and more intelligent than its brethren, would it be able to escape a hunting osprey?"
"I doubt it," said Aragon, "at least not for very long."
"Just as ospreys are designed to be the best possible hunters of fish, wolves are designed to be the best hunters of deer and other large game. And every animal is gifted to best suit its purpose. So too are the Razak designed to prey upon humans. They are the monsters in the dark, the dripping nightmares that haunt your race."
The back of Aragon's neck prickled with horror.
"What manner of creatures are they?"
"Neither elf, man, dwarf, dragon, furred, finned, or feathered beast, reptile, insect, nor any other category of animal."
Aragon forced a laugh. "Are they plants, then?"
"Nor that either. They reproduce by laying eggs like dragons. When they hatch, the young, or pupae, grow black exoskeletons and mimic the human form. It's a grotesque imitation, but convincing enough to let the Razak approach their victims without undue alarm. All areas where humans are weak, the Razak are strong. They can see on a cloudy night, track a scent like a bloodhound, jump higher and move faster. However, bright light pains them, and they have a morbid fear of deep water, for they cannot swim. Their greatest weapon is their evil breath, which fogs the minds of humans, incapacitating many, though it is less potent on dwarves, and elves are immune altogether."
Aragon shivered as he remembered his first sight of the Razak in Carvajal, and how he had been unable to flee once they noticed him. "It felt like a dream where I wanted to run, but I couldn't move, no matter how hard I tried."
"As good a description as any," said Aramis. "Though the Razak cannot use magic, they are not to be underestimated. If they know that you hunt them, they will not reveal themselves, but keep to the shadows where they are strong, and plot to ambush you as they did by Dras Leona. Even Brom's experience could not protect him from them. Never grow overconfident, Aragon. Never grow arrogant, for then you will be careless, and your enemies will exploit your weakness."
"Yes, master."
Aramis fixed Aragon with a steady gaze.
"The Razak remain pupae for 20 years while they mature. On the first full moon of their 20th year, they shed their exoskeletons, spread their wings, and emerge as adults, ready to hunt all creatures, not just humans."
"Then the Razak's mounts, the ones they fly on, are really..."
"Aye, their parents." Image of Perfection.
"At last I understand the nature of my enemies,"
thought Aragorn. He had feared the Razak ever since they first appeared in Carvajal, not only because of their villainous deeds, but because he knew so little about the creatures. In his ignorance, he credited the Razak with more powers than they actually possessed, and regarded them with an almost superstitious dread. Nightmares, indeed. But now that Oromus's explanation had stripped away the Razak's aura of mystery, they no longer seemed quite so formidable. The fact that they were vulnerable to light and water strengthened Aragorn's conviction that when next they met, he would destroy the monsters that had killed Garrow and Brom. "Are their parents called Razak as well?" he asked.
Oromus shook his head. "Leatherblacker, we name them. And whereas their offspring are narrow-minded, if cunning, Leatherblacker have all the intelligence of a dragon. A cruel, vicious and twisted dragon.
Where do they come from?"
"From whatever land your ancestors abandoned. Their depredations may have been what forced King Palancar to emigrate. When we, the Riders, became aware of the Razak's foul presence in Alagazia, we did our best to eradicate them, as we would leaf blight. Unfortunately, we were only partially successful. Two Leatherblacker escaped, and they, along with their pupae, are the ones who have caused you so much grief. After he killed Vrail, Galbatorix sought them out and bargained for their services in return for his protection and a guaranteed amount of their favourite food. That is why Galbatorix allows them to live by Drasleona, one of the Empire's largest cities." Aragorn's jaw tightened. "They have much to answer for. And they will, if I have my way."
"That they do," Oromus agreed. Returning to the hut, he stepped through the black shadow of the doorway, then reappeared, carrying a half-dozen slate tablets about a half-foot wide and a foot high. He presented one to Aragorn.
"Let us abandon such unpleasant topics for a time. I thought you might enjoy learning how to make a ferth. It is an excellent device for focusing your thoughts. The slate is impregnated with enough ink to cover it with any combination of colours. All you need do is concentrate upon the image that you wish to capture, and then say, 'Let that which I see in my mind's eye be replicated on the surface of this tablet.'"
As Aragorn examined the clay-smooth slate, Oromus gestured at the clearing.
"Look about you, Aragorn, and find something worth preserving."
The first objects that Aragorn noticed seemed too obvious, too banal to him. A yellow lily by his feet, Oromus's overgrown hut, the white stream, and the landscape itself. None were unique. None would give an observer an insight into the subject of the ferth or he who had created it.
"Things that change and are lost, that is what's worth preserving," he thought.
His eyes alighted upon the pale green nubs of spring growth at the tip of a tree's branches, and then the deep, narrow wound that seamed the trunk, where a storm had broken a bough, tearing off a rope of bark with it. Translucent orbs of sap encrusted the seam, catching and refracting the light. Aragorn positioned himself alongside the trunk, so that the rotund galls of the tree's congealed blood bulged out in silhouette and were framed by a cluster of shiny new needles. Then he fixed the scene in his mind as best he could, and uttered the spell. The surface of the grey tablet brightened as splashes of colour bloomed across it, blending and mixing to produce the proper array of hues. When the pigments at last stopped moving, Aragorn found himself looking at a strange copy of what he had wanted to reproduce. The sap and needles were rendered with vibrant, razor-sharp detail, while all else was slurred and bleary, as if seen through half-opened eyes. It was far removed from the universal clarity of Oromus's Ferth of Illyria. At a sign from Oromus, Aragorn handed the tablet to him. The elf studied it for a minute, then said,
"You have an unusual way of thinking, Aragorn Finiarel. Most humans have difficulty achieving the proper concentration to create a recognizable image. You, on the other hand, seem to observe nearly everything about whatever interests you. It's a narrow focus, though. You have the same problem here that you do with your meditation. You must relax, broaden your field of vision, and allow yourself to absorb everything around you, without judging what is important or not."
Setting aside the picture,
Orimis took a second blank tablet from the grass and gave it to Aragorn.
Try again with what I...
Hail, rider!
Startled, Aragorn turned and saw Oric and Arya emerge side by side from the forest. The dwarf raised his arm in greeting. His beard was freshly trimmed and braided, his hair was pulled back into a neat ponytail, and he wore a new tunic, courtesy of the elves, that was red and brown and embroidered with gold thread. His appearance gave no indication of his condition the previous night. Aragorn, Oromis, and Arya exchanged the traditional greeting. Then, abandoning the ancient language, Oromis asked,
"To what may I attribute this visit? You are both welcome to my hut, but as you can see, I am in the midst of working with Aragorn, and that is of paramount importance."
"I apologize for disturbing you, Oromis Elder," said Arya. "But..."
"The fault is mine," said Oric.
He glanced at Aragorn before continuing,
"I was sent here by Hrothgar to ensure that Aragorn receives the instruction he is due. I have no doubt that he is, but I am obliged to see his training with my own eyes, so that when I return to Trondheim, I may give my king a true account of events."
Oromis said, "That which I teach Aragorn is not to be shared with anyone else. The secrets of the riders are for him alone."
"And I understand that. However, we live in uncertain times. The stone that once was fixed and solid is now unstable. We must adapt to survive. So much depends on Aragorn. We dwarves have a right to verify that his training proceeds as promised. Do you believe our request is an unreasonable one?"
"Well spoken, Master Dwarf," said Oromis.
He tapped his fingers together, inscrutable as always.
"May I assume, then, that this is a matter of duty for you?"
"Duty and honour."
"And neither will allow you to yield on this point?"
"I fear not, Oromis Elder," said Oric.
"Very well. You may stay and watch for the duration of this lesson. Will that satisfy you?"
Oric frowned.
"Are you near the end of the lesson?"
"We have just begun."
"Then yes, I will be satisfied, for the moment at least."
While they spoke, Aragorn tried to catch Arya's eye, but she kept her attention centered on Oromis.
"Aragorn."
He blinked, jolted out of his reverie.
"Yes, Master."
"Don't wander, Aragorn. I want you to make another Ferth. Keep your mind open, like I told you before."
"Yes, Master."
Aragorn hefted the tablet, his hands slightly damp at the thought of having Oric and Arya there to judge his performance. He wanted to do well in order to prove that Oromis was a good teacher. Even so, he could not concentrate on the pine needles and sap. Arya tugged at him like a lodestone, drawing his attention back to her whenever he thought of something else. At last he realized that it was futile for him to resist the attraction. He composed an image of her in his head, which took but a heartbeat, since he knew her features better than his own, and voiced the spell in the ancient language, pouring all of his adoration, love, and fear of her into the currents of fey magic. The result left him speechless. The Ferth depicted Arya's head and shoulders against a dark, indistinct background. She was bathed in firelight on her right side, and gazed out at the viewer with knowing eyes, appearing not just as she was, but as he thought of her, mysterious, exotic, and the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. It was a flawed, imperfect picture, but it possessed such intensity and passion that it evoked a visceral response from Aragorn.
"Is this how I really see her?"
Whoever this woman was, she was so wise, so powerful, and so hypnotic, she could consume any lesser man. From a great distance, he heard Saphira whisper,
"Be careful."
"What have you wrought, Aragorn?" demanded Oromis.
I don't know."
Aragorn hesitated as Oromis extended his hand for the Ferth, reluctant to let the others examine his work, especially Arya. After a long, terrifying pause, Aragorn pried his fingers off the tablet and released it to Oromis. The elf's expression grew stern as he looked at the Firth, then back at Aragorn, who quailed under the weight of his stare. Without a word, Oromis handed the tablet to Arya. Her hair obscured her face as she bowed over the tablet, but Aragorn saw cords and veins ridge her hands as she clenched the slate. It shook in her grip.
"Well, what is it?"
asked Oric. Raising the Firth over her head, Arya hurled it against the ground, shattering the picture into a thousand pieces. Then she drew herself upright and with great dignity walked past Aragorn, across the clearing, and into the tangled depths of Duweldenvarden. Oric picked up one of the fragments of slate. It was blank. The image had vanished when the tablet broke. He tugged his beard.
"In all the decades I've known her, Arya has never lost her temper like that, never! What did you do, Aragorn?"
Dazed, Aragorn said, "A portrait of her." Oric frowned, obviously puzzled.
"A portrait? Why would that?"
"I think it would be best if you left now," said Oromis. "The lesson is over in any case. Come back tomorrow or the day after if you want a better idea of Aragorn's progress."
The dwarf squinted at Aragorn, then nodded and brushed the dirt from his palms.
"Yes, I believe I'll do that. Thank you for your time, Oromis Elder. I appreciate it."
As he headed back toward Ellesmere, he said over his shoulder to Aragorn,
"I'll be in the common room of Tildari Hall if you want to talk."
When Oric was gone, Oromis lifted the hem of his tunic, knelt, and began to gather up the remains of the tablet. Aragorn watched him, unable to move.
"Why?"
he asked in the ancient language.
"Perhaps," said Oromis, "Arya was frightened by you."
"Frightened? She never gets frightened."
Even as he said it, Aragorn knew that it was not true. She just concealed her fear better than most. Dropping to one knee, he took a piece of the Firth and pressed it into Oromis's palm.
"Why would I frighten her?" he asked. "Please tell me."
Oromis stood and walked to the edge of the stream, where he scattered the fragments of slate over the bank, letting the grey flakes trickle through his fingers.
"Firths only show what you want them to. It's possible to lie with them, to create a false image, but to do so requires more skill than you yet have. Arya knows this. She also knows, then, that your Firth was an accurate representation of your feelings for her."
"But why would that frighten her?"
Oromis smiled sadly.
"Because it revealed the depth of your infatuation."
He pressed his fingertips together, forming a series of arches.
"Let us analyze the situation, Aragorn. While you are old enough to be considered a man among your people, in our eyes you are no more than a child."
Aragorn frowned, hearing echoes of Saphira's words from the previous night.
"Normally I would not compare a human's age to an elf's, but since you share our longevity, you must also be judged by our standards. And you are a rider. We rely upon you to help us defeat Galbatorix. It could be disastrous for everyone in Alagasia if you are distracted from your studies." "Now then," said Oromis, "how should Arya have responded to your Firth? It is clear that you see her in a romantic light, yet while I have no doubt Arya is fond of you, a union between the two of you is impossible due to your own youth, culture, race, and responsibilities. Your interest has placed Arya in an uncomfortable position. She dare not confront you, for fear of disrupting your training. But as the Queen's daughter, she cannot ignore you and risk offending a rider, especially one upon which so much depends. Even if you were a fit match, Arya would refrain from encouraging you, so that you could devote all of your energy to the task at hand. She would sacrifice her happiness for the greater good."
Oromis's voice thickened.
"You must understand, Aragorn, that slaying Galbatorix is more important than any one person. Nothing else matters."
He paused, his gaze gentle, then added, "Given the circumstances, is it so strange
Arya was frightened that your feelings for her could endanger everything we have worked for? Aragorn shook his head. He was ashamed that his behaviour had caused Arya distress, and dismayed by how reckless and juvenile he had been. I could have avoided this entire mess if I'd just kept better control of myself. Touching him on the shoulder, Oromis guided him back inside the hut. Think not that I am devoid of sympathy, Aragorn. Everyone experiences ardour like yours at one point or another during their lives. It's part of growing up. I also know how hard it is for you to deny yourself the usual comforts of life, but it's necessary if we are to prevail.
Yes, master.
They sat at the kitchen table, and Oromis began to lay out writing materials for Aragorn to practice the Lidwyn Kvedi.
It would be unreasonable of me to expect you to forget your fascination with Arya, but I do expect you to prevent it from interfering with my instruction again. Can you promise me that?
Yes, master, I promise.
And Arya? What would be the honourable thing to do about her predicament?
Aragorn hesitated.
I don't want to lose her friendship.
No.
Therefore, I will go to her. I will apologize, and I will reassure her that I never intend to cause her such hardship again.
It was difficult for him to say, but once he did, he felt a sense of relief, as if acknowledging his mistake cleansed him of it.
Oromis appeared pleased. By that alone you prove that you have matured.
The sheets of paper were smooth underneath Aragorn's hands as he pressed them flat against the tabletop. He stared at the blank, white expanse for a moment, then dipped a quill in ink and began to transcribe a column of glyphs. Each barbed line was like a streak of night against the paper, an abyss into which he could lose himself and try to forget his confused feelings.
The Obliterator.
The following morn, Aragorn went looking for Arya in order to apologize. He searched for over an hour without success. It seemed as if she had vanished among the many hidden nooks within Ellesmere. He caught a glimpse of her once as he paused by the entrance to Teal Dari Hall and called out to her, but she slipped away before he could reach her side.
She's avoiding me, he finally realized.
As the days rolled by, Aragorn embraced Oromis's training with a zeal that the elder rider praised, devoting himself to his studies in order to distract himself from thoughts of Arya. Night and day, Aragorn strove to master his lessons. He memorized the words of making, binding, and summoning, learned the true names of plants and animals, and studied the perils of transmutation, how to call upon the wind and the sea, and the myriad skills needed to understand the forces of the world. At spells that dealt with the great energies, such as light, heat, and magnetism, he excelled, for he possessed the talent to judge nigh exactly how much strength the task required, and whether it would exceed that of his body. Occasionally, Oric would come and watch, standing without comment by the edge of the clearing while Oromis tutored Aragorn, or while Aragorn struggled alone with a particularly difficult spell. Oromis set many challenges before him. He had Aragorn cook meals with magic in order to teach him finer control of his grammary. Aragorn's first attempts resulted in a blackened mess. The elf showed Aragorn how to detect and neutralize poisons of every sort, and from then on, Aragorn had to inspect his food for the different venoms Oromis was liable to slip into it. More than once, Aragorn went hungry when he could not find the poison, or was unable to counteract it. Twice he became so sick Oromis had to heal him. And Oromis had Aragorn cast multiple spells simultaneously, which required tremendous concentration to keep the spells directed at their intended targets and prevent them from shifting among the items Aragorn wanted to affect. Oromis devoted long hours to the craft of imbuing matter with energy, either to be released at a later time or to give an object certain attributes. He said,
"This is how Runan charm the rider's swords, so they never break or dull. How we sing plants into growing as we desire. How a trap might be set in a box, only to be triggered when the box is opened. How we and the dwarves make the Eristar, our lanterns. And how you may heal one who is injured, to
to name but a few uses. These are the most potent of spells, for they can lie dormant for 1,000 years or more, and are difficult to perceive or avert. They permeate much of Alagasia, shaping the land and the destiny of the